Nothing in science is deeply metaphysically true. And probably all of our concepts, ultimately, are merely pointers and very, very fallible pointers. The only way to know the truth is to sit in silence and be the truth.
Collective Insights is a voyage through topics and technologies revolutionizing human well-being. Groundbreaking approaches for a better world and a better life await you. Welcome to Collective Insights.
Hi, I'm Dr. Dan Stickler. Before we get into today's episode, I want to talk to you about a protocol that I'm passionate about that I use in my practice. You know, everyone wants to slow down aging, but few are really doing it the right way. There's something I do recommend for my clients doing just 2 days a month. It's a bodily cleanse that helps get rid of old defective cells. These are sometimes called senescent cells or referred to as zombie cells. And they are shown to be related to so many symptoms of poor aging. This bodily cleanse is a supplement which contains a group of ingredients called senolytics. Senolytic ingredients help our body to flush senescent cells, helping with easier repair and rejuvenation from muscles to joints to how we feel every day. Qualia Senolytic is the bodily cleanse supplement taken just 2 days a month for healthy aging that you have to try. Now, research on aging and longevity, including a beta study on Qualia Senolytic, shows that senolytic supplementation can play a huge role in enhancing how we age. Now, to learn more about senolytic research and to try Qualia Senolytic risk-free for 100 days, go to neurohacker.com, use the code PODCAST, that's P-O-D-C-A-S-T, for a free gift with purchase. That's Qualia Senolytic for better aging at neurohacker.com.
Welcome to this edition of Collective Insights. I'm Dr. Daniel Stickler, medical director here at the Neurohacker Collective. And today I have an amazing guest, Dr. Donald Hoffman. He's a professor emeritus of cognitive sciences at the University of California, Irvine, and author of over 100 scientific papers and 3 books, including Visual Intelligence and his new book, The Case Against Reality. Donald, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan, for inviting me. Very kind.
Yeah, I've been excited to interview you for many reasons. I started following your work in like 2010, 2011, I believe.
Okay.
And you and Bo Lotto. And I was able to interview Bo Lotto about a year ago and had a great interview with him. And now I'm like, oh, I get to interview Donald Hoffman. This is the great piece about being a podcast host, because you get to interview the people that you really look up to and look to for information. It's interesting because you spent your career basically delving into neuroscience, philosophy, consciousness. I mean, you've gone across many different specialty areas. But your main focus in using all three of these areas is essentially truth, and the truth about reality. What is this thing that we call reality? And do we actually experience the way we think or do we see it the way we think we are seeing it? And let's go from there. So what inspired you to really first go into the exploration of the nature of reality?
Well, I was very interested even as a teenager, because I was getting a different story at school than I was getting when my dad, and who was a pastor at a church. So I was getting a different story at a Christian fundamentalist church about the nature of reality than I was getting, in my science classes at school. And so I was very interested. I mean, I had, of course, spent lots of time in church, so I really knew that story very well. And I spent a lot of time in science classes and found it fascinating. And it was obvious that the science was giving us technology that worked, and the religion wasn't. So there was a difference in what they could offer in terms of actual practical stuff. But on the other hand, maybe science was missing something important. So I decided I needed to sort of look into it myself. And I decided that the way I wanted to tackle this was to ask the question, are we just machines? In some sense, the physicalist framework of science lended itself toward the idea that maybe we're just molecular machines. That's all we are. We're collections of molecules and atoms, and consciousness is a latecomer in the universe, and when we die, that's it, and we return to the atoms and molecules dissembled that we once were. Or there's the view that we're something more, that there's something maybe more eternal about us, or timeless about us. And I decided the way to really ask this question in a way that could give me an answer was artificial intelligence was around at the time when I was in my teenage years. We're thinking about that kind of stuff. And, you know, computers were taking off. And so I finally framed the question, I needed to study artificial intelligence and ask, are we machines? What could machines do? Could machines really be truly intelligent? Could they do more than just be truly intelligent? So I ended up ultimately at MIT in graduate school in the artificial intelligence laboratory, where I actually then got to work on technical problems in artificial intelligence, and then also in what's now the brain and cognitive science department at MIT, where then I could study cognitive neuroscience. And so I worked on both, but as you know, you have to do something concrete for your PhD. If you go for the big question, good luck. You won't solve it, and you won't get your PhD. So you have to choose something small and technical. So I worked on visual perception and made some small contributions to visual perception. But that was in the direction I wanted to go, because I'm interested in the question about consciousness. So is consciousness just a product of neural activity, or does it go deeper? So in other words, the question is really the framework of science has been a physicalist framework for many centuries. Space and time, or their union into space-time since Einstein, has been the foundation, right? Space fundamental entities. And after millions or billions of years of evolution, physical and biological, you finally get creatures like us that are alive and have conscious experiences. So that's one framework. And it's been very powerful, right? And as I said, any technology that we're using right now comes from science and from that framework. So on the other hand, there are questions that come up from the scientific theories themselves about that whole framework of space-time being fundamental. And that's where, see, I didn't want to use religion to try to tackle the question of science, because it doesn't have the right tools, right? Science has mathematically precise theories. So I realized you really need to understand science on its own terms and then look at its scope and limits on its own terms. Mm-hmm. And the nice thing about scientific theories is that they're mathematically precise. And so they tell you not only what you can do with the theories, the scope of the theories, but also where the theories stop, where they no longer apply. In case of Einstein, for example, and his theories of space-time, of course, the scope is tremendous. It's transformed our lives, and technologically as well as intellectually. You know, Einstein's theory of space-time and gravity, and his work on this photoelectric effect and other things. But his theory of space-time is so precise mathematically that it also tells us, in interaction with his work on quantum theory, especially the photoelectric effect, his work on that, tells us that basically his idea of space-time has a strong limit. It doesn't make sense. It has no operational meaning past what's called the Planck scale, 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, 10 to the minus 43 seconds. And so that's pretty impressive. Space-time itself, as powerful as it's been as a framework, is not the final reality, it appears. That kind of reality stops at 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, and you can't go smaller. There's no way to go smaller inside space-time. Now, physicists in the last 10 years, just in the last decade, who recognize this, they recognize that space-time has a beautiful scope, but it has really hard limits. It cannot be foundational. It can't be fundamental. And that means it's particles, the electrons, protons, neutrons, photons, and so forth, quarks and gluons. those particles are stuck inside space-time, so they can't be fundamental either. So the physicists that in the last decade made their first steps outside of space-time. They're actually finding stuff out there. It's mathematical stuff. So they're finding mathematical structures. The big label for it is something called positive geometries. So there's now a big push into positive geometries like the amplitudehedron, associahedron, and cosmological polytopes, and then also some combinatorial objects that sort of help classify these positive geometries, things like decorated permutations. So it's a word salad right now for most people. It's a word salad, but in the last 10 years, this word salad is pointing to incredible intellectual achievement and adventure. Right, this is really adventurous. These researchers are going outside of space time. They're not looking for little tiny things curled up inside space time. These are structures outside of space time. So science is taking a new step, and so that's also quite intriguing to me. That space time is not fundamental, and so now to sort of circle around to the your question. ultimately, then, my attitude has been: space time isn't fundamental. What is? And so I've been working on a theory in which consciousness is fundamental, because I've become convinced that our attempts to boot up consciousness from inside space-time, like and many of my good friends and colleagues are working on this. There's integrated information theory, orchestrated collapse of microtubule quantum states and neurons. There's global workspace theory. There's tons and tons of theories where they assume kind of substrate inside space-time is fundamental. And if it has the right kind of functional properties or causal structure, then it gives rise somehow to, or is identical to, conscious experiences, or identical to the illusion of conscious experiences. And what's remarkable to me is, I know the players, many of them are friends or certainly colleagues. They're brilliant. There's no question they're brilliant. But it's also striking that despite decades of effort, there's not a single specific conscious experience that any of their theories can account for. We can't say what is the orchestrated collapse of quantum states that must be the taste of vanilla or the sound of a trumpet or whatever. There's not one. And if you go to each one of these physicalists or, even the panpsychist theories, where you ask them, can you explain any specific conscious experience? They can't. So that's a stunning failure, and I think the failure is principled. So that's why I'm going for a theory that in which consciousness is fundamental, and then my burden is to show how space-time and physics arises from something that's starts with consciousness. And I have to do it I have to connect with the structures that the physicists are finding outside of space-time, the amplitudehedron and so forth, the decorated permutation. Because they found these static structures, but they haven't found any dynamical systems yet. And so we're working on a dynamical system of consciousness. The idea is to show that it projects onto the new positive geometries that the physicists have found outside of space-time. And then the physicists then take us into space-time from those positive geometries and show us how to connect with the physics that we know and love inside of space-time. So long answer to your question, but just to summarize, it looks like our scientific theories about space-time are precise enough to tell us that space-time isn't it. Space-time is not fundamental. That's not a religious conclusion. That's a scientific conclusion. And we don't just throw up our hands and say, space-time isn't fundamental. No, they're actually finding, they say, okay, let's go out there and find what's more fundamental. They're finding stuff. They're finding positive geometries. And it just so happens that it looks like we'll be able to connect our theory of conscious agents, which are by definition outside of space-time. So we're not talking about little agents inside space-time. We're talking about conscious agents prior to space-time. And by the way, it's all a mathematical model. So it's not just, again, words. It's a precise mathematical dynamics. And we're working right now and making progress in making precise mathematical connections between the dynamics, Markovian dynamics of these conscious agents to the positive geometries that the physicists have found, with the goal ultimately to be able to show how all of space-time and like particle behavior, quantum particle behavior inside space-time arises from consciousness prior to space-time. So that's been my long odyssey, is to, you know, from teenage years where I say, okay, you know, I got these contradictory views of the world from science on the one hand and spirituality on the other. Can I, for myself, figure out how to reconcile them? Right now, it looks like, well, we can take something from both. The idea that consciousness is fundamental, but from the spiritual side, but then the mathematical rigor from the scientific side, and come up with a scientific theory of consciousness outside space-time, and then show that the physical world arises from consciousness precisely, rather than the other way around. The standard story that the physical world is fundamental and consciousness somehow arises from complex interactions of matter.
So you've taken this down a whole different area, and I'm glad you did, because this is a lot of this stuff that I've been kind of wondering about lately, and I think probably a lot of our listeners have too, that have been studying any of this. I know you mentioned the integral information theory and a couple of others, but is there anything that even really right now comes close to a definition in consciousness?
Well, among my colleagues and friends who are doing physicalist kinds of theories, they will either, there's two big approaches. One is to say that consciousness is an illusion. So it's just a user illusion. It's that there's no such thing that actually answers to consciousness. All you really are is just a complex physical system, you know, a neural network of some kind. And that neural network, for example, has circuits that monitor other circuits. So like the attentional schema theory, you have these meta circuits, the attentional circuits that are monitoring other circuits in the brain, and that gives you the illusion, that meta level of neural activity gives you an illusion of conscious experiences. And then there are others that say consciousness is real. It's a real phenomenon, but it's created by, you know, it somehow emerges from neural activity or the right kind of causal structure. Now, so to answer your question, the first group that says consciousness is an illusion, well, that's their definition, right? There's nothing that answers to consciousness. It's just a user illusion. So that's what they would say to your question. Yeah. Most of my colleagues, though, who are physicalists, would say, no, consciousness isn't an illusion. But then they would say, you know, and how do you define it? Well, like integrated information theory will give you several properties that it has to have, that something has to have to be conscious. But what all these theories do is they don't just say, let's give a model of consciousness qua consciousness. Instead, they give a model of a substrate. This is, for example, in the case of integrated information theory, they give you properties that a substrate must have for that substrate to, in some sense, be identical with or generate consciousness. And so all of them are saying that consciousness is something that arises when a substrate has the right properties. And what I'm saying is, no, consciousness itself is sui generis without need of a substrate. So it's there without, you don't need a substrate. And what our job to do as scientists is to model the mathematical structure of consciousness itself. Just like in a physicalist framework, at some point we thought that space-time was the final reality. You don't need some deeper substrate than space-time. Say space-time is the reality. No further deeper substrate needed to generate space-time. And what your job to do in physics then was to write down the mathematics that describe space-time directly, not some substrate that gave rise to space-time. I'm saying that's what we need to do with consciousness. don't write down mathematical models of substrates and how they generate consciousness. Look consciousness straight in the face and say, what model of consciousness do we need? What model of mathematical model do we need to directly model what we're talking about in consciousness? And so for that kind of thing, there may be people who are trying to do that directly. Most are trying to model substrates, like physical systems, for example, that would give rise to consciousness. So they would say that, to answer your question, consciousness is something that emerges from some prior substrate. And so where I differ from, I would say 99%, I'm probably overlooking some theories that start with consciousness, qua consciousness, and give mathematical models of it. But what I'm saying is, you'll start with a substrate. Consciousness itself is in this framework, the final reality. And we need to model that directly with mathematics.
That is some deep stuff.
Fun. It's fun.
It is. And, you know, just trying to think about it. I mean, quantum physics was enough of a quandary for me, but then getting into consciousness was a whole new territory that really kind of blew me away. And it actually led me more towards Eastern philosophy and religion. And how do you see that playing into all of this, the philosophy and religion, especially of the Eastern cultures?
Well, I think that the philosophy and religion, East, and the mystical traditions of the West, which are similar in flavor, like Benedictine monks, for example, and Kabbalah in Judaism, I would say that they're saying something very, very similar to what I'm saying with my mathematical model of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
In some sense, they could say, well, yeah, welcome to the party. You guys are latecomers. You've been stuck in space-time, and we've been telling you that that's not where it's at for many, many centuries, millennia even. They've been saying that there's some deeper reality. Now, and I think that they're right. The difference is that they've been using just natural language to talk about it. And what we've learned in the last 500 years, 600 years in science, is if you really want to understand how nature works, and if you want to have ideas that you can actually show where their strengths are and what their limits are, and then begin a real vigorous process of theory building, where you're not just saying the same old stuff century after century, you're actually saying stuff and then showing where it's wrong or where it's limited, you need to do mathematics. Mathematics isn't the territory, but it's the language that you need to describe the territory. And that's what we've found. You need, and so effectively, one way I could think about what I'm doing is I'm taking the ideas of the perennial philosophy, the deep mystical ideas, East and West, that have been around for millennia, and putting them in simple mathematics and saying, let's take these ideas and make them precise. And that way we can find out what these traditions have told us for millennia as well. That what they will tell us, the Buddhists will say, for example, the finger pointing to the moon is not the moon. Right, it's just a pointer. And what they're saying is that all the words and teachings that they give you are not the truth. You're the truth. You need to just take the pointers and use the pointers. Don't be a dog that looks at the pointing finger and then only looks at the finger. Look where the finger is pointing. So the traditions, the spiritual traditions, have at their best for thousands of years told us, don't take the words as the dogma. Mm. Take them as pointers. Take the teaching as pointers. And if it doesn't help you, drop the words, drop it, and just go with what it's pointing to. The thing that science gives us are precise pointers, mathematically precise pointers that tell you their scope and their limits. Natural language doesn't really clearly tell you the limits. Even though these spiritual teachers would say, like the Tao Te Ching starts off by saying the Tao that can be spoken is not the true Tao. Mm-hmm. But then the writer goes on to write a lot of words, right? And the point is that once you understand that the words are just pointers, it's safe. But what happens is we get dogmatic. And we, you have to say it this way, and this, and so eventually the followers, I mean, the spiritual leaders, I think, had deep insights, but it's easy for the followers who aren't on the same level to become dogmatic and then have infighting and then, you know, wars, kill each other over. So what science brings to the table is we can talk about these spiritual ideas that have been around for thousands of years, but with a more precise language that tells us exactly where our new pointer stops, what it's good at and what it fails at. And that is a beautiful antidote to dogmatism, but it's also a powerful engine for evolving ever better pointers that we can use to help in the spiritual journey. So that's where I see, you know, just to circle back to your question and sort of tie it up, how's what I'm doing related to this Eastern and Western mystical traditions? I would say what I'm saying is very, very similar in spirit. That what's new is it's now being made mathematically precise. And I'm no longer saying that you have to use this kind of incantation of words and so forth. No. I'm just saying here is now a theory about consciousness that I will say right up front is not the final theory of everything. It's just another baby step in science. And that's not false modesty. I honestly view it as a little baby step. And there are going to be many, many more steps, hopefully ahead as we progress. And so I'm not proposing a theory of everything. I'm proposing the next baby step, partly because I think that science itself can never give us a theory of everything. There's no possibility because of the nature of scientific theories. And there's a scientific theory says, grant me these assumptions. If you grant me these assumptions, I can explain all this wonderful stuff based on those assumptions. Mm-hmm. But of course, the theory doesn't explain the assumptions. It assumes its assumptions. It doesn't explain them. And you can say, well, I'll give you a deeper theory that explains those assumptions. Indeed, you probably can with some effort. But your new theory will have its own assumptions. And this goes on ad infinitum. So science, I'm a scientist. It's an incredible gift to humanity. It's a wonderful tool, the scientific precision, the notion of scientific theories. It's an incredible gift. But there will never be a scientific theory of everything. And even if we proceed with science for a billion years, my take is we will have scratched basically not even the surface of reality. Mm-hmm. And yet, we should do it. Reality is incredible. It's infinitely complex. And science gives us interesting projections. You know, it's like the thing about the elephant and the blind men, right? Mm-hmm. One feels the tail, one feels the trunk, and they get different pictures of it. Well, that's what science is doing. Whatever reality is, it transcends any scientific theory. But a scientific theory is like touching one part of the elephant and saying, well, from this perspective, it looks like a rope. From this perspective, it looks like a tree trunk, or it feels like a tree trunk, and so forth. So science is useful, and incredible technologies come out of it. So I see a rapprochement between science and spirituality. Mm-hmm. But the rapprochement has a shock for both sides, right? It's a bit shocking on the spiritual side to think about talking about this stuff with mathematics. That's a bit of a shock, and having precise experimental tests that might actually show that something that we've said for 1,000 years might in fact be deeply wrong or have a limit that we never thought. So that's shocking. On the other hand, for the scientists, the idea that space-time isn't fundamental, right, is deeply shocking. Most of my colleagues aren't aware of that. The scientists who are the most deeply aware of it are a particular group of physicists. They're called the high-energy theoretical physicists. And the reasons that they're the ones that are on this is their domain. They're the ones that are exploring what happens to space-time and particles in space-time when you go to the very, very high energies. And that's where you find, holy smoke, it falls apart. Okay, well, it can't be fundamental. So it's a small group, and word hasn't really got out to most everybody else, partly because, hey, when I'm doing chemistry and so forth, space-time is perfectly fine, thank you. I mean, I'm not anywhere near the Planck scale, so I don't need to worry about space-time is not fundamental. If I think that consciousness is fundamental, it's on me to give a mathematically precise theory of consciousness outside of space-time and show precisely how I can predict experiments inside space-time, like scattering experiments at the Large Hadron Collider. Mm-hmm. If I can't do that, then no one should pay attention, period. So that's the burden on someone like me, is to say, you're talking a big talk, give us predictions that we can test. So that's what I and my team are up to. But you can see, the rapprochement is going to give both sides, science and spirituality, pause. Because mathematics is new to the spiritual side, and the idea that something that we've been saying for thousands of years might be shown wrong is, or very limited, is that bites. And on the science,
especially if it's a foundational concept that everything's built on.
Yeah, exactly. And in the case of science, space-time has been the foundational concept on which everything is mm-hmm. built on, and we know it's over. And we don't know what's the new framework. We're finding these new geometries, the positive geometries, but what is this world that these positive geometries are inhabiting? What is that about? No one knows. So you can see, it's for me, as a scientist, this is like incredibly fun. This is just as fun as it gets.
Now, you have a strong background in AI, and do you think AI is going to be able to really accelerate this this exploration at this point and maybe come up with an answer?
I use AI as a collaborator right now mm-hmm. when I'm working on technical problems in the theory of Markov chains and so forth. And I'm having to do such multidisciplinary research that there's no way that I can be an expert in everything. So I have to learn enough to be able to think creatively in these various areas, like information theory and so forth, mm-hmm. Theoretical physics. So it's easy for me to come to the limits of my technical knowledge. And so I know enough that I can ask, like Bard. I can ask Bard, Google mm-hmm. Bard, clean technical questions. In fact, I did one this morning. One technical question about Markov chains. And Bard then comes back. And so it's like having an expert in these various fields. I have to be careful because the AIs right now can create stuff out of thin air. So you have to be careful.
Yeah,
that they hallucinate. That's right. So I don't take I've had them hallucinate for me. So I've had to look at what they say, but at least they give me some hints that are useful sometimes. And other times I say, oh no, that's a complete hallucination. So. I think that AIs are already being a help. They're not yet at the point where I think that they can go after the big, deeper questions. I mean, the limitations are still quite clear on that. And I think another aspect of your question is, could the AIs actually become conscious, right, themselves? Mm-hmm. And on that, when most people ask that question, they're asking it in the framework of physicalism. So can a physical system, such as a computer, properly programmed, get complicated enough that somehow the unconscious circuits and software suddenly get the magic of consciousness arising out of them? That's sort of the general kind of framework. Mm-hmm. And I think that whole framework about thinking about it is just wrong. Space-time isn't fundamental. Consciousness does not arise out of dynamical systems of particles inside space-time. Mm-hmm. So that whole framework is wrong from the get-go. But again, 99% of my colleagues would beg to disagree with me on that. They would say, no, we'll start with physical stuff like neurons or circuits and software, and we'll boot up consciousness.
But you're talking about the physicalists instead of the panpsychists or the cosmopsychists that would say it's already exactly. conscious.
Yeah, they would say, so where I differ with many of the panpsychists is they'll say, yeah, consciousness is not arising from the physical. It's the reality behind the equations of physics, in some sense, right? It's the reality that the inner life of the proton, if you wish, the inner life of the electron and so forth. And I think that that's fine as far as it goes, but I think it's not thinking big enough because it's stuck still inside the space-time framework. Physics is already telling us that space-time can't be it, and they're finding new stuff outside it. So why should we have our theory, our panpsychist theories tied to the laws of physics inside space-time? We know that can't be right. So that's where I disagree with many panpsychists. If they just say, look, consciousness is fundamental inside space-time, which is just one little tiny venue for consciousness, then we can talk about how consciousness is related to the laws of physics. But most of them are thinking still in the old framework in which space-time is the fundamental reality, and then the laws of physics inside space-time are in some sense the best science can do about fundamental reality, and consciousness just fits in as the fire that breathes life into the equations inside space-time.
So let's get to some of the more relevant stuff for the everyday person in regards to reality. One of the questions I had for Bo Lotto when I interviewed him is there an objective reality at all? How would you answer that one?
Well, if you're thinking about objective reality as like space-time, then no. Space-time is more like a headset, a VR headset that we're using to interact with reality. But the space-time itself is not the reality. My own take on what I think that there is a reality, and as I said earlier, that it transcends description by science, but that science can give us mathematically precise descriptions of projections of reality. But reality itself is infinitely complicated. It's probably indivisible in some deep sense. So spiritual traditions talk about the one, for example. And I think they're onto something. In my own mathematical model of consciousness, my model of quote unquote reality, conscious reality, starts off with little conscious agents, right? So these aren't the infinite one. It's a bunch of little conscious agents. And why do I do that? Because that's what I can do with mathematics, right? Now, it turns out when these conscious agents interact, they form bigger conscious agents. So I can start to climb up and get to more and more complicated conscious agents, even infinitely big ones. But the mathematics tells me very clearly that I'll never be able to climb up to the point where I talk about the one. I'll always be infinitely far away from that. And so that's one reason why I'm saying my stuff is just a baby step. So I think that there is a reality, and I can only point to it by pointers like using the phrase the one and saying it's a unified consciousness. I would have loved to give a mathematical model of it. I think it's not mathematically possible. I think that we can do infinite exploration of it with mathematics, endless exploration of projections of it, and continue to learn. So there's endless things that we can learn in science about the one, and it will always infinitely transcend everything that we've learned, even if we go out at it for a trillion years. So that's what I mean when I say it's complicated. We could have trillions of Einsteins working for trillions of years and making great progress the whole time, and still have 0% progress on understanding the nature. And that's my other aspect of what I'm thinking about this is I agree with what spiritual traditions say, is that that infinite undivided one is not separate from you and me. It is you and me. We're just, Don is just an avatar. Dan is just an avatar of that one infinite consciousness. And so in some sense, the idea that what we're doing is waking up to who we truly are. We are consciousness that has been looking at itself through a particular little headset, little projection, and learning what it is by learning what it's not. I am not Don Hoffman. Don Hoffman is just my avatar. I'm not Dan Stickler. Dan Stickler is just an avatar. So, but for a long time, for many decades, I thought it was Don Hoffman. I was completely identified with, and in fact, I still am. I don't let go of that identification easily. Meditate, I do science, and if you catch me off guard, I'm Don Hoffman, and I'm identified with my body and so forth. So I'm.
But fundamentally, you have that knowing of you are not that.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
And it's also another area that I wanted to go into a little bit in, how consciousness influences things or has a relationship to the concept of free will. I guess first I should ask you, what's your feelings on free will?
Well, I think that it's a useful perspective. So in a physicalist framework, there's no room for free will. So if I was a physicalist, there's room for randomness and probability, but there's no room for free will in a physicalist. Now, there can be an illusion of free will. In some sense, you could say, well, your brain is so complicated. So I'm talking in a neuroreductionist kind of physicalist framework. In that, you might say, well, I have free will, and I think Dan Dennett would say this, I have free will because I do what I want. Now, of course, it's my brain that's doing it, but I am my brain, so I'm doing what I want as long as nothing's restraining me. So what more free will do you want? He would say. So he would say we have free will. But there's a deeper notion of free will which says that I have, I'm completely free to choose whatever I want to choose to do. And I think that that's a useful perspective to have in our everyday life. Mm-hmm. For example, am I going to choose to be kind to this person or not? Am I going to choose to, there's all these things where it's a useful perspective to say, I have the freedom to choose to be kind to this person. And so I'm going to choose to do that. As opposed to saying whatever happens is going to happen, and I have no freedom. It's very useful in the context of the legal system, legal moral behavior to have the notion of free will.
Yeah, I know Dr. Sapolsky's been making some rounds in the criminal circuits.
But your question is a deep one, and if I go deeper, there's a question about. Does the one have free will? Mm. What would that even mean? It almost doesn't even make sense. I mean, the free will is sort of assuming a framework in which you have a limited perspective, you have a range of options, and you're having to choose among a set of options. I'm not sure that applies to an infinite intelligence. Mm. The very idea of deliberating over a finite set of options and trying... It may even be just the wrong framework to apply. So in other words, that's our concepts and our words. And this is something that spiritual traditions have said for, I think correctly, for thousands of years. Concepts are just concepts. They're not the thing. Our words are just pointers. Free will is a pointer. I think it's a useful pointer for us inside space-time in terms of our everyday behavior. Is it deeply true? I think spiritual traditions would say none of our words are deeply true. The truth completely transcends any words. So in my mathematical model of conscious agents, there are these probabilistic choice points where an agent can make a probabilistic choice. I think it's perfectly fine to talk about that as a free choice of the conscious agent. But I'm not going to make any deep metaphysical claims about it. I'm just going to say, in the context of this theory, which is not a theory of everything and which will be overthrown, I'm talking about, it's useful to think about that as a free will choice. Is it deeply metaphysically true? No, nothing in science is deeply metaphysically true. And probably all of our concepts, ultimately, are merely pointers and very, very fallible pointers. The only way to know the truth is to sit in silence and be the truth.
Mm-hmm. That's a quote that's going to go on the on the social media for sure. I love that.
But it's sort of like the only way to know cinnamon is to actually put some on your tongue and taste it, right? Until you taste it. Now, I can talk to you for thousands of years with all the theories about cinnamon until you put it in your mouth and taste it. Those are just words.
Yeah.
It's the taste. That's the real thing.
Yeah, I was reading some of Sam Harris's work on the illusion of free will, and that was where I was. I had gotten to the point of saying, yeah, free will is an illusion, but it's a useful one. And then he goes on to say, well, the illusion of free will is an illusion as well. And so I saw how that just kept going deeper and deeper. And, you know, I don't know, like you say, when you talk about the one, that does it even apply at all?
Right. Right. Yeah, I think it may not apply at all. And even if for us it applies only as a limited concept. Now the arguments, there are arguments against free will that I disagree with. The arguments against free will that assume neuroreductionism, I disagree with.
Mm-hmm.
I may come to the same conclusion. I may conclude that free will is at best a useful but false concept. But I don't come at that conclusion from the same way that the neuroreductionists do. They say, look, we have good evidence that from brain activity, we can predict several seconds ahead of time what a person is going to do. Several seconds before they could tell you what they're going to do. We know from the neural activity and motor cortex, whatever, some part of the cortex, what they're going to do several seconds down the road. So therefore, from a neural point of view, it's the brain that's causing. And I think that whole approach is completely uncompelling.
Yeah,
I don't deny the experiments. The experiments are completely correct. They're wonderful experiments. That it's the neural reductionist framework of interpretation that's wrong. To be very, very clear, I think that neurons do not exist when they're not perceived.
Yeah.
Period.
I
like now, I have no neuron. I have no neurons, and most of my colleagues who in the neurosciences, my good friends, would tend to agree with me right now. Yeah, Hoffman, right now you apparently have no brain when you say that kind of stuff. But I'm saying local, I'll put it in physics terms, local realism is false. The idea that physical systems like particles or neurons have definite physical properties like position, momentum, spin, frequency of oscillation, whatever, local realism is false. It's just plain false, and science has come to that point of view for particles, and I'm saying it's true of neurons as well. So neurons, and I'm a cognitive neuroscientist, I think we need more funding for neuroscience, not less, because it's much more complicated than we ever thought. Neurons are just a user interface description of something that's much more complicated than neurons. 86 billion neurons sounds complicated enough. It's trivial compared to the complexity behind space-time that maps into what we call neurons. Yeah. So the neuroreductionist arguments have no weight for me whatsoever, because the fact is neurons just don't even exist when they're not perceived. So neurons cause none of my behavior, and you can't reduce my conscious choices or my free will, if there is such thing, to neural activity.
And just recently, the scientific papers that came out that said there is no local reality kind of goes along with that.
Well, that was the Nobel Prize in 2022.
Yeah.
So John Clauser, Anton Zeilinger, and Alan Aspect were the three experimental particle physicists who tested the predictions of quantum theory on this point about local realism. Local realism is false. Now, there are some, like Sabina Hassenfelder, who will say, no, it didn't really show local realism was false. It showed that they just showed that superdeterminism is true. That's a completely separate thing. But my take is, probably it may be that superdeterminism is true and local realism is false, both. but there are clean examples of quantum systems where you can prove that if you make a particular measurement of a property of one particle, you will, with probability one, get a certain outcome. So you know with probability one what you're going to see, like spin up or something like that. But you also know from the actual design of the system that this particular system, that value of the spin could not possibly have existed until you made the measurement. You can prove it. Yeah. So there is no question that there are quantum systems where we know with probability one what you're going to see when you measure, and we know with certainty that that value did not exist until we measured it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the Nobel Prize was really for showing that that's ubiquitous. The values don't, it's ubiquitous that there aren't real values inside space-time until you make measurements. Then you get positions, momentum, spin, and so forth. So that's my take on it. And therefore, if brains and neurons are made out of particles that for which local realism is false, then the brains and neurons themselves don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing for them to be composed of. So that's why I say I have no neurons right now.
I love how you have taken so many different disciplines and looked at how they all interrelate with each other. I mean, the psychology, the mathematics, the physics, the science, the philosophy, and even religion. I'd love to see more universities having the multidisciplinary approach to studying consciousness, for sure.
Well, I've had many, many wonderful collaborators over the years. There's no way that I could know all these disciplines by myself. So,
yeah,
I mean, I have mathematicians working with me like Chetan Prakash and also Bruce Bennett, who basically tutored me and coddled me and helped me when I couldn't understand the math and so forth. And then philosophers who work with me and so forth. So I've had wonderful graduate students. So this kind of work is not one lone guy doing it by himself. Yeah. It's me working with tons and tons of brilliant geniuses who kindly took their time to teach me remedial things that I needed to learn in their disciplines.
Well, and you honored their perspectives on that too, which is where a lot of the conflict, people just won't cross those boundaries. So.
Right. And by the way, I should say that even with my colleagues, one which I disagree with, I love to be good friends with them, right? It's perfectly, I mean, there's nothing personal in all this. And in fact,
learn a lot from disagreement.
Absolutely. And even though I disagree with them, most of them are so much smarter than me, I can't understand how much smarter they are. They're really brilliant. So I'm not saying they're dumb. They're smarter than me. So I don't know.
Well, this has been a real pleasure. I want to honor your time here. And wow, I mean, much different than I anticipated, much better for sure. Now, I know it's going to be good, but, you know, the areas we went into, that was incredible. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Dan. A real pleasure to talk with you.
This podcast is for informational purposes only. The podcast is not intended as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. You should not use the information on the podcast for diagnosing or treating a health problem or disease, or prescribing any medication or other treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider before taking any medication or nutritional, herbal, or homeopathic supplement, and with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have heard on this or any other podcast. Reliance on the podcast is solely at your own risk. Information provided on the podcast does not create a doctor-patient relationship between you and any of the health professionals affiliated with our podcast. Information and statements regarding dietary supplements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration and are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to therein. If you think you have a medical problem, consult a licensed physician. This podcast is owned by Neurohacker Collective.